Well, good morning. My name is Steve Buckley. I'm from the Information Technology and Systems Department here at MIT. I'm also one of the co-founders of the MIT CIO Symposium about 12 years ago. It's always great to see this event growing up year by year. Also, welcome to MIT on an absolutely glorious spring day following on our winter of discontent. This is also exam week at MIT, so in keeping with that, I hope you're all paying attention because there'll be a brief quiz at the end of today's agenda. It's my pleasure to introduce this morning my old friend and colleague, Professor Marshall Van Alstyne. Marshall is one of the primary research associates of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy that you heard about earlier from my friend David Verrill. Marshall is also one of the world's foremost experts on platforms and strategies and network business models. He's a frequent speaker, board-level director, and consultant to both startups and global firms. Marshall will be speaking this morning with an interesting panel, and I hope you enjoy the talk. So let me present Professor Marshall Van Alstyne.
Well, good morning. I think Steve has been a little generous in some of the introductions, but I have the pleasure of introducing a couple of folks I think perhaps even more successful and more accomplished than I. We have a panelist of quite remarkable speakers who have a number of remarkable accomplishments on their own. Let me start with a couple of the co-panelists. Brian Kirshner, we have some wonderful stories about the backgrounds of each of them. Brian joins us as the director of Apigee. Apigee, as many of you may know, is one of the premier companies developing APIs, or application programming interfaces, for firms. He's been building out enterprise APIs for years. Matter of fact, he's one of the enthusiasts putting this stuff together. He was just coming to us from NASDAQ just yesterday, explaining some of this technology. Brian has also an interesting background. Many of you might not know. He was one of the first open source evangelists at Microsoft, at a time when open source was probably a dirty word around Microsoft. He managed to secure for himself the director of open source strategy at a time when that was quite difficult. And now, of course, it's conventional wisdom with Microsoft Azure, so it's quite an accomplishment that he did that. Also, one of you might not know that he has a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy from Yale. This is, again, quite a deep thinker about this. You might not also know that facts are an aphrodisiac for Brian. There's a great set of stories. It turns out on his first date with a woman named Holly, he observed as they're crossing the street, rather than going straight ahead and to the left, the best path was, of course, diagonally across the street. This highly intelligent woman, rather than observing that you'd taken more distance through traffic, said, "Of course, it's the hypotenuse." They've been happily married ever since. So again, Brian is expert in this and really terrific. With that, I'd also like to introduce the next speaker, Paddy Srinivasan. Paddy comes to us as the Vice President of Product Design at Zively. Before this, he's been working on the enterprise applications of the Internet of Things. So we'll have quite a bit to speak about on the Internet of Things as possible platform. He has previous engagement at LogMeIn. He's built a couple of successful startups. So I don't know how many of you have actually been CIOs spinning off different companies. Our third panelist will actually speak to us specifically about taking CI role and actually launching companies in this. I think we're going in the other direction, interestingly, here. Paddy also has prior leadership experience with Microsoft Office and .NET. Also Oracle experience with database product engineering. So deep technical expertise in addition to expertise on platforms and strategy. So we'll have some interesting things to hear about from there. Our third person, Jerry Wolf, let me introduce, is currently the CEO of Vivenda. Vivenda is a startup coming out of McCormick. What's interesting is that many of us think of technology companies as spinning as the canonical examples of platform firms. So you might think of them as coming out of SAP or Microsoft or open source. He built a platform company out of McCormick Spice. So I challenge you, interesting question, how in the hell are you going to build a platform out of salt and pepper? Jerry has actually done this, and quite remarkably so, in a way that they've actually spun off a very interesting company, Vivenda, to do this. In fact, he has other prior experience in growth strategies at the firm. He also has a Bachelor of Arts in Economics and Political Science, and even has deep expertise in supply chain management. He will even be able to speak to us on how the CIOs educate the CEOs in proper strategy for the business. So we'll really look forward to more of that. In any event, I'd like to get started with a little bit of history and some of the platform shifts that I think are taking place. So I want to challenge you with a notion of why it is that businesses are changing in their new form. What is it about platforms that are different than traditional business models? I'll start with a really simple question. 2 years ago, what was the most famous company in the world? Hint, some of you might be drinking some of their products around lunch. Any guesses? Well, 2 years ago, the most famous company in the world was Coca-Cola. That has recently changed. Interbrands put out a survey of the most famous companies in the world. What's interesting is that Google and Apple have now displaced other firms in terms of brand recognition. Google spends less on advertising alone on the entire globe than Coca-Cola spends in the US alone. It is interesting that by working on customer engagement, they have actually made themselves so famous, so indispensable, that everyone knows who they are. The fastest growing companies in terms of name recognition are Amazon, Google, and Apple. All of them are platform companies. If you press this data a bit further, just in terms of fame or notoriety, 13, oh, those are the fastest growing, 13 of the top 30 are platform companies. By this I mean they have external ecosystems. They have pools of developers. IBM, Microsoft, Samsung, Intel all have external developers. But we include in this companies like American Express or eBay, or even in some cases Nike, that have built external communities on top of their companies. So again, just in terms of name recognition. In terms of technology footprint, the same is also true. Platform companies are overwhelmingly dominating the internet. This is a plot of accesses, and you can see YouTube, Google, Facebook, and others. And it doesn't matter where you're shining the spotlight. If you look over at Asia, well, then you will find Baidu, and you'll find Taobao, and you'll find Alibaba and Alipay. Again, it's these platform companies that are coming to dominate the technological space. So that's fame. This is technological footprint. What I really want to draw your attention to, however, is economic value. In terms of economic wealth created, three of the top five firms are now platform firms by market capitalization. We have Apple, Microsoft, and Google joining the ranks of ExxonMobil and Berkshire Hathaway. Platform firms have begun to displace energy and banking as the dominant firms in terms of wealth creation. And in fact, this is a trend that's been going on for more than a decade. If we sort the economic value created by platform firms, this is simply market cap of the top 20 firms ranked all the way back to the turn of the decade, turn of the century, the proportion of value captured by platform companies has been on a continuous rise and seems positioned to do so for some time to come. So that's interesting. I want to argue that the platform business model is broken. So how many of you have a BlackBerry? Or how many of you are willing to admit you have a BlackBerry? So it's worth observing what happened with market share for BlackBerry. And I want to argue again, the product business model is broken relative to the platform business model. Your job as CIO is going to be helping to make these kinds of transition. The facts speak for themselves. In a mere 4 years, from 2009, BlackBerry went from almost half the market, 40% market share, to 2% market share in 2013. That's hard to do. Right? That's not something you want to have accomplished necessarily. Okay? I also want to draw your attention to the shape of that curve. It's convex down. And I'm going to argue that network effects are one of the prominent drivers of that phenomenon. Again, part of the job, and this is network effects working against a company as opposed to network effects working for a company. We just observed that Apple is now the most valuable company in the world. It wasn't always so. If we go back to the 1980s and 90s, this is a plot of the market capitalization in blue of Microsoft relative to the market capitalization of Apple in red, flatline. What's fascinating is that Apple may have had a better product, Microsoft built a better ecosystem. It built the better externalities. It had six times the number of developers, more than six times the number of applications by the time of the antitrust trial. It won overwhelmingly. Better product design doesn't win. Better ecosystems design, better platform design wins every time. And it's not just then. You can also take a look at any of the popular firms now. I borrow someone else's slide, presenter on SlideShare. These are other examples of these network effects in order. If we take a look at Etsy, or Skype, or Airbnb, or Line, Uber, all of these are exponential growth, indeed built by external ecosystems. How is it you capture the wealth? How is it you cause this exponential growth to take place on top of your platform? These are the effects that we'd like to try to capture and that we'll be speaking to in the panel this morning. But I want to argue, we'll hear a great deal over the course of this event about SMAC, social, mobile, analytics, cloud. I'm going to argue that that's actually only the tip of the iceberg. The forces are actually bigger than that. You'll hear a very nice talk at the end of the day by Andy McAfee on the future is close, you know, things in the future are closer than they appear. I'd like to argue that many of these forces, in fact, are bigger than they appear. Let me see if I can give you illustrations of why that's the case. If we look at some of the biggest firms, and I want to draw parallels between firms at the turn of the century in the industrial era and firms now at the turn of the century in the internet era. What was it that drove the giant firms? Quick pass on what the definitions of platforms are. I want to emphasize before that, products have features. Platforms have communities. It's essential you build these external communities. You cannot get network effects if you haven't built the external communities. These are what's really going to be the drivers. The goal is going to be helping people find what they need, matching them to content, matching them to other individuals, using the platform to create transactions value in the external environment. Why, again, do I think these forces are so big? Let me see if I can draw parallels between industrial-era firms and internet-era firms. In any market with network effects, we're going to actually turn the focus of the firm from inside when you're managing HR, managing innovation, managing finance, managing strategy. We've got to turn the focus of the firm to outside when we start to manage the external community. The reason is actually quite simple. There is no way to scale network effects inside the firm as rapidly as you can scale them outside the firm. There are simply more people outside the firm. That's why the focus has to shift, and managing the information technology element is going to be profoundly different inside the firm than it is outside the firm. Again, let me see if I can show you again why this might be the case. The giants of the industrial era were all based on supply-side economies of scale. These were massive fixed costs, low marginal cost. There were two large electricity companies, Westinghouse and Edison. Same thing's true of automobile manufacture. Again, giant supply-side economies of scale. There were two, Ford Sloan. Again, benefactor of the MIT Sloan School is one of the folks in there. What about steel? After the Bessemer process was produced, Germany, England, the United States had giant steel production. It was almost impossible to compete with these monopolies. And then even in railroads, we had the colossus of railroads as you managed to take a tax of all of the internet or all of the interstate commerce. Now, you're being able to take a tax on the internet commerce that takes place. A fascinating series of analogies. There's another word for network effects. Economists call this a demand-side economy of scale. What we're now seeing is value creation on the opposite side of the profit equation. That is, users are creating value for other users. That's how we're getting exponential growth, and that's what's happening outside. If we take a look at the giant firms, if we take a look at the exponential growth, we get companies like Microsoft and operating systems with a completely dominant market share. Or in news, we get Twitter, again, completely dominant market share. It would be extremely difficult to reproduce that organization, not on a supply side economy of scale, but on a demand side economy of scale. It's not just social network, it's the network effect. Alibaba, largest firm for internet commerce in the world. And similarly, Facebook, also a demand side economy of scale. The shifts these manifest are actually quite profound. We teach in the business school a lot of different things on a lot of different activities. So I'm going to argue that network effects invert the firm in very interesting ways. In finance, we teach maximizing shareholder value. Now we're going to use the CIO function to maximize stakeholder value and create value outside the firm. In strategy, you create entry barriers and inimitable resources. That's not true here. You open the platform and you get the people on the long tail to build. That's how we get Angry Birds built on top of the platform. In the information technology function, we might have started with originally in the back office, Then we got ERP systems. Then we moved to the front office. We got CRM systems. I'd argue now we're even moving out of office as we're getting social that's completely outside the organization. Or if we look at operations and logistics, right? We used to teach. So here is a wonderful observation about Uber being the largest taxi company but doesn't own a taxi. Airbnb is the largest hotel company but doesn't actually own real estate. Alibaba, largest internet firm, doesn't have inventory. Or Facebook, largest content provider, doesn't create any content. We used to teach just-in-time inventory. Now you can actually optimize not even mine inventory. It's a whole different way of viewing things. So again, it's a very different perspective as how we might invert the firm, and the information technology is based on a new set of economics from demand-side economies of scale. So with that, again, let me turn to our panelists and give each of them in respect a couple of minutes to speak on the respective issues. So please, let's hear from Brian. Thank you.
Thanks, Marshall. Delighted to be here with you and with this panel. I'm not sure when you heard the hypotenuse story. I'm not sure if that's so much about facts being an aphrodisiac for me or my wife being tolerant of geeks, but I'll take it either way. So I've been involved with platforms for a long time, and in my few minutes, I'd like to make the case for you as CIOs, as technologists, that you ought to drag your COO, your CFO, your general counsel here next year. Because platform strategy is relevant to them too, and I'll just go through three examples, right? So APIs, application programming interfaces, have always been at the core of platform strategy. So to go back to the Microsoft example, if you've used Windows anytime in the last 30 years, you've seen a little box pop up that says something like, do you want to do this? Okay, cancel. That's a message box. It's called with one line of code through a message box API. Very handy for developers building on Windows to be able to build things faster using the API set on Windows. And there is a strategy and revenue decision made back in the day. Microsoft decided the software development kit for those APIs would be free. Apple wanted to charge $10,000 for it, and you saw how the market played out back then, right? It galvanized a much bigger complementary ecosystem. More recently, you may have used a Google map that's been plopped down into someone's website or into an app. So a modern web API like that, Google pushes this out to the market, is the most widely used mapping program. There is a commercial license if you want to use it internal to your company or if you want high traffic. So that's interesting. They can charge for that. But mostly it's free because they collect the data from the uses of that map. And they've done different things to try and harvest more data over time. Some they've terminated, some they've continued, things like favorites, reviews, right? So Google is using that API, that modern web API, to provide a service, but to harvest the data back. So this is why whatever business you're in, I'll say, make the transition to why others among your executive team should be here next year, and you should be the evangelist of getting them to understand APIs and platform strategy. So Walgreens uses this great phrase, the pharmacy, putting an API around our stores. So they have photo printers in their stores. And what they did was they created an API for those photo printers. So not only can you print from your Walgreens app, print the photos on your phone to this printer, they have a partner ecosystem. So where are your photos? Yeah, they're on your phone, but also maybe they're on Instagram. So from Instagram, you can print to your nearest Walgreens photo printer. And to take that a step further, they've got a loyalty program, right? Your activities with Walgreens gets you loyalty points, gets rewards. That's great. Lots of retailers have them. You can connect your fitness device or your Runkeeper type of app to their loyalty program, and so you'll get rewards for meeting the fitness goals you wanted to meet already, reinforces their brand, your connection to Walgreens. But someplace like Jawbone has a developer ecosystem. Folks who are using their APIs to build apps that leverage the Jawbone device. So now you connect your Jawbone device to CVS. Now think about that if you're a retailer. You're competing with a loyalty program which not only has everything that CVS can do, everything that its ecosystem around the printers can do and Instagram can do, but everything the Jawbone ecosystem can do, right? It's now an ecosystem of platforms. And so as technology changes, the web becomes pervasive, devices become pervasive, essentially everyone, for all practical purposes, on the consumer side has a smart device. Every industry is going to have that opportunity or that challenge to figure out how you can expose data and services and turn that into an asset for your business and go the platform route.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Betty?
It's an honor to be on this panel. Professor Marshall, you've set up the stage really well. And it's surreal to be on the panel with a fellow Microsoft colleague after 10 years of leaving Microsoft. But I work on a product called Zively, and my day job is to help work with physical product companies, so companies that have been business that have been in business for tens of years, sometimes 60, 70, 80 years, to help them make a big transformation. And that transformation can be very succinctly summarized as companies are going from being a product company to a product as a service company. And regardless of what that product is, it could be a sprinkler, it could be an industrial oven, it could be a jet engine, there's a slow transformation from just selling hardware to selling hardware and associated services. So one of the things that is really fascinating to observe is that in this transformation from a product to a product as a service, the challenges come in two forms. One is there's a technology challenge, a lot of the things that Brian outlined, but very importantly, there's also a business challenge. So there's a challenge around how do you set up your business to be successful. And in our experience, in my experience, I have noticed successful companies that are undergoing this transformation or in the process of kicking off this transformation do this for very specific reasons, and it can be summarized into a couple of very interesting business reasons. One is they want to use their physical product as a platform, which is very different from having software as a platform. So they want to use the physical product as a platform to either sell more of the same product or sell other products from their company, or use that product to sell more consumables if that product lends itself to that model. So that's one reason, to drive the top line to sell more. The second one is to use products that are inherently connected in one way or the other to reduce or optimize on the service cost, on the delivery of services to that consumer of the product. So this could be in reduction of truck rolls or making more efficient truck rolls or what have you. And the third reason is using these products, they want to establish a close relationship with the user of the product. And one of the things that was really interesting to us was many of these product companies never even knew who was actually using the product. And with connectivity comes opportunity, and that opportunity is to actually not only know who your customers are, but start forming a tight relationship with them through the platform services and the ecosystem that Professor talked about. So the underlying phenomenon here is that hardware, especially in the consumer space, hardware is becoming more of an acquisition tool. So where you actually make money or where your business starts separating itself from your competition is in all the other services and the ecosystem value that you can deliver through this product into the hands of the consumer directly. So it's really interesting to not only see how platforms are having a profound impact on the economy, but also how, at a microscopic level, how it can really transform your business, and this is not just for software platforms, but it's for hardware products as well.
Fantastic. That's very interesting. So, Jerry, give us your perspective on the transformation. What's took place at McCormick?
So, first of all, thanks. It's a huge honor to be here on the panel with these esteemed gentlemen. So my job is to give you a case study, and I'm going to do that by talking a little bit about the job I used to have and the job I have now. So guess what? We're going to talk about food. You thought this was about technology. We're going to talk about food. Everybody likes to eat, right? Yeah, right? You like to eat. Anybody want to put their hand up that doesn't like to eat? What do you do more often than eating? You know, in the United States, we spend about $1.7 trillion a year eating. $1.7 trillion. If you look in the food space that McCormick participated in, that space, that subset, which is the stuff we buy at a grocery store, is a little over a $600 billion industry. Within that industry, enormous sums of money are spent trying to convince you to buy stuff. About $45 billion. A third of that, $15 billion, is spent making you aware of things. The other $30 billion is spent typically driving a hot price at a grocery store on the fundamental belief that you're going to walk up and down the aisles and see it. That's a model that got created after the Second World War. It basically defines modern marketing. Let's talk about how well it's working today. And let's say over the last 5 years. Would it surprise you if I told you that that $30 billion it's spent convincing you to buy stuff has a negative ROI of 30%? That's right. $30 billion, it's the single largest discretionary line item in a consumer goods company's P&L, and it has a negative ROI of 30%. Now here's the good news. The other $15 billion, which is spent on promotion is and awareness marketing typically, that's still got a slightly positive ROI. It comes from about 50% of the spend, and yes, I'm going to say the cliche line, we just don't know which 50. Now, in case you think this whole network of food thing is working very well, right? It's not Food Network, it's not where Bobby Flay works, the network of food, the grocers, the manufacturers, the bloggers, the content providers, the restaurants. So if you're thinking that that's working really, really well, let's take a look at our consumer behaviors in store. You know, in the average store, grocery store, there's about 35 to 40,000 products available for sale. That's not all food, but a lot of food in there. What do you think the percentage of that portfolio is that the average household buys? 0.7%. Round numbers, 270-odd unique items out of 40,000 things for sale. Talk about confusion from complexity. Here's another stat. You didn't think you'd learn this much about the food industry at a tech discussion, did you? Another important stat. Every year, thousands and thousands of new products are launched. You know what the success rate is? 3%. 3%. There are billions of coupons printed every year to get you to try stuff. They also have a negative ROI of 30%. So why did I tell you all that? Because people, in spite of all that, people are bored with what they eat. Average household in the U.S. makes 9 meals, not because they want to, it's because they have all kinds of barriers that keep them from trying different things. It's a huge issue. Second thing, in that $600 billion ecosystem that I talked about, there are 14 billion shopping trips executed every year. And each one for each family is like they've never done it before. It's completely fragmented. Think about how connected we are. And yet, this thing that we do all the time has about as little automation and help to it as it could possibly have. People hate it. Do you know what the greatest, in the last 15 years, surveys been done with moms asking the question, what are the 10 most stressful things in your life? Do you know, without exception, somewhere between 1 and 3 for 15 years running is the simple question, Mom, what's for dinner? Now we're going to start talking about platforms. So at McCormick, we played in that world. You probably think of McCormick as a spice company. Marshall, I think, said it before. It's a spice company. Put spices on stuff. You buy spices. It sells spices. It's a branded spice company. It's a pretty big one. It's $4 billion plus. It's a global company. Here's the challenge. The challenge was that growth was decelerating. And in my job as the CIO, there was a plus piece of it, and I got to work on some interesting transformational stuff over the years. And so I got the opportunity to ask the question as to whether or not the emergence of the connected consumer in a low consideration industry was going to had afforded opportunities to change our growth prospects. Here's another little interesting thing to know. E-commerce for food is less than 2% of the total. So yeah, it's nothing. Who cares? Can't drive growth with that. 50% of what's purchased is influenced digitally, and the number's rising. Uh-oh, maybe there's something to do there. And so what we did was we incubated a bunch of ideas. It was all centered around the connected consumer. Early on, we incubated some ideas. We found that if we presented solutions in context to a consumer, chicken's on sale, use this flavor with it, magic. Consumer got a solution that she wanted. McCormick sold more stuff. Retailer sold a bigger basket. Stacked win. Everybody won. Problem was we couldn't scale it. But we had an idea. So here's where the platform comes in. So then we looked at what we had, and we got some inspiration from Pandora Radio. Who listens to Pandora Radio? Most everybody, right? You know what it is? Yeah, love Pandora. The inspiration from Pandora was, what if we could create for the food space the equivalent of the music genome? McCormick was uniquely positioned to do that. 125-year-old company, but 30 years and over $1 billion of investment in food science, sensory science, and culinary expertise from around the world, understanding why we like what we like. Not that piece of it wasn't about how to clean spices. It was about making choice of food. And then the inspiration was, instead of using that inside, and here's the network part, what if we could give it to everyone? What if we could put it in your pocket and help you make choices around food? We created this thing called FlavorPrint. In simple terms, a FlavorPrint is a flavor and texture profile of any kind of food, a recipe, a product, a menu item, anything. It's unique. Flavor and texture, 10,000 aroma chemicals boiled down into 33 flavors. And we could do it algorithmically based on that data set, that massive data repository we had. So we stood up a big data platform, did some nice analytics against it, wrote some very cool algorithms, and then we did a second thing. We figured out how to profile you. And then we matchmake. We make recommendations to you. So we baited it, we tried it on McCormick web properties. It was killer. The registered users, unpromoted, engagement, every kind of metric you could imagine was a factor greater than what a non-flavor print profiled user was. And they bought more. Growth. Wow. And then to bring it all together, but it wasn't going to be big enough if we just did it inside McCormick. It needed to be everywhere. And so using some technology from Apogee, we made it API enabled so it can plug in. And we created this little company that I'm running now called Vivanda to get it everywhere so that you could use it everywhere. So we could make that network of food better serve you. So this little company, Vivanda, is an example of a platform-based company. It's a services platform. It got incubated in a 125-year-old CPG business. But it's very much about helping everybody that's in this network of food get back to getting and putting some wins on the board. So that's the case study.
Fantastic. Let me start with a couple of questions. I'll go back in something in reverse order on some of these questions. So let's start with a couple of questions for Jerry. We'll give it two. One of these is, in a platform sense, often if you're thinking of growth, you think of horizontal integration, you think of vertical integration. Horizontal integration from McCormick, you're adding cilantro to salt and pepper. Vertical integration, you'd be backward integrating into mining or growing your salt and pepper. You had this idea of functional integration. How does functional integration serve to grow the platform or serve to grow your community? What does that mean?
Yeah, the functional integration was really thinking a lot about the fact that we needed partners in order to better serve the consumer and grow. And the platform thinking was a framework to really enable our intentions for collaboration. Because it was beyond synchronizing data, but it was the ability to actually synchronize the creation of an experience. I mean, that's in the end what brands are about. They're about promises and experiences. And there's only so much you can do with a 30-second TV spot or a banner ad that its click-through rate is at a lower probability or a higher probability than you getting or lower probability than you getting struck by lightning.
So it's timely they just canceled Mad Men.
What's that?
It's timely they just canceled Mad Men.
Yes.
So the second question for you, we're at a CIO summit. You were CIO of McCormick.
Right.
This was a technology play, and if I remember correctly, the CEO was an old sales and marketing guy figuring out how to actually sell more spice and get it into the hands of the others. How do you convince the CEO or the board to try a strategy like this? What educate our audience on how you would do that.
So I'll tell you a secret. So first I'll tell you the straight answer, and then I'll tell you the secret. The straight answer is talk about growth. Come to the table with ideas about how to grow. And pound your fist on the table and demand to be heard and ask the question whether anybody else has a better idea. The secret, the tricky part is, if you get 5 minutes with the board and they're asking you questions about cybersecurity, ask them if you can have 30 seconds at the end to talk to them about what's going on in the industry and maybe opportunities that might be there. That's how we convinced the management team, because I actually got 5 minutes with the board during one of my routine tech updates. And I said, there's something I really think you guys would like to know more about. That created positive pressure on the management team because the board asked who's got a better idea. And that's what started.
Of course, it's going to be this CIO audience, so I'm delighted to hear that. Thank you. Let's turn to Patty, see if you have a couple of ideas extending on this. You've mentioned that customer engagement is especially important in building out these platforms. How do you achieve that? What happens when you actually increase the level of customer engagement? Or what steps would you take using your technology platforms to improve that customer engagement?
Okay, great question. So I think, first of all, companies have to realize that they have to engage with their customers. And we are talking about, in most instances, physical product companies have very little idea on who's actually buying or using their product. And with technologies of today, with everyone becoming connected and even products becoming connected, have a very unique opportunity to start forging that direct relationship with the users of the product. And it is not to disintermediate your value chain, your distribution network, or installers, or service people that have worked with you for decades. But it is really to fulfill on an obligation that in today's day and age, even in an industrial setting, your customers are expecting to be engaged. And what does that mean? They are expecting to be engaged to know a little bit more about how they're using the product, to Jerry's example. They want instant feedback when they are stuck. So for example, I'll go back to a sprinkler example. So you just got the sprinkler, you're trying to set it up, and obviously it's very complex. And you have an application that you're using to program this, and I am stuck. I want to be just able to push a button and immediately get technical support from the manufacturer of the sprinkler. I don't want to set an appointment. I don't want to wait from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. on a Wednesday morning to have some technician show up and help me set it up. I want to be able to turn the camera on my phone, show the panel, and in 30 seconds, I want someone to point out how to make this wiring work. So that's the expectation from the users of your products. And there are technologies available today that helps you fulfill on that obligation. And another interesting thing that we have observed is that, I think it was the CEO of GE who said, every company will become a software company. And to underline that fact, we are working with industrial companies that don't have the expertise to do what we take for granted in the technology space. So for example, how do you run a 24/7 customer service operation? Well, the minute you have a product that is digitalized in some sense, your customers expect customer service, engagement, 24/7 support. So physical product companies need to